morning, but hopefully we'll warm things up as we go through our service today. This morning, we're going to once again be looking at the providence of God and taking a look at what that means in our lives when we consider the providence of God around us. Last week, in looking at the providence of God, one of the things that we brought out and considered was that God is not a timeless God. Sometimes we have this idea that God is just transcendent and timeless overall, and that everything just kind of runs according to His laws that He's established and that He's put in place. And this gives rise to the idea that we do see a lot today, and that's the idea of naturalism, that everything has a natural explanation. Everything happens now, everything happened in the past can just be explained by nature. And once we go into that degree of naturalism, then the natural thing is to go to what we call materialism. And that really is that this material universe is all that there is, and that everything can be explained by the laws that are part of our universe. We've been looking at the providence of God, and this shows us that God is involved in our universe, that He sustains everything that is, that He created everything, and He didn't just create everything and then move back. He's involved with everything. He's in time with us. He's a personal God. He hears our prayers, and He takes care of us. And by providence of God, we mean that sustaining hand that God has throughout everything that happens, that He does sustain the universe, that He does sustain us as His people. And that's what we'll be considering as we go through and consider the providence of God this morning in the life of Queen Esther and Mordecai that we just read about in our scripture reading. When we think about the providence of God, one of the problems that people have sometimes is that, well, if God takes care of everything, if He's sovereign over the universe and knows everything that's going to happen, why is there so much evil and suffering in the world around us? Well, how do you explain all the bad things that happen? Like the tsunami that happened a few years ago, that hundreds of thousands of people were killed in just a couple minutes. Why does He allow such things like that? And that's one of the ideas that we'll be covering and thinking about as we go through the providence of God. Now, we've looked at three ideas with the providence of God. First, Paul brings out the idea that, yes, there is suffering and trials that we face in this world, but they really just don't matter. They don't even compare to the glory that will follow. We look for a salvation world. We look for the hope that will come afterwards. The second idea that we have that we sometimes want to forget is Satan is still present in this world. Paul calls Satan the ruler of the air over everything. Jesus calls Satan the prince of this world. Satan is still active, and he still has God, even though he's sovereign over all, allows Satan in our world to really truly be the ruler, the prince of this world. And the third idea that we'll be looking at as we go through, the providence of God still allows us free will. And we'll be taking a look at the idea of our free will this morning. Now, when we look at the providence of God and you think, well, God knows everything that's going to happen. The foreknowledge of God is not a really easy subject for us to think about. It's something that causes us a lot of problems. We talk in the Bible, and there's a number of scriptures that talk about the foreknowledge of God. But what do we mean by the foreknowledge of God? Does that mean that God knows everything that's going to happen? Everything is just an open book before His eyes? There's some that think that's exactly what the foreknowledge of God looks like. And that may well be. The other way to look at the foreknowledge of God is God knows exactly what His plans and purposes for the future are. But exactly how those happen may not have been determined yet. So we look at the foreknowledge of God. You may be surprised. There aren't any scriptures that really tell us what the foreknowledge of God means. The Bible mentions the foreknowledge of God, but there's not any scriptures in the New Testament or in the Old Testament that says exactly what does it mean for the future to be in God's hands. In Psalms 139, the psalmist talks about that David talks about that God knows me, knows everything about me and what will happen to me. But it's pretty much in poetic language, and it's hard to say exactly what the psalmist means. And in Isaiah chapter 46 is one of the passages sometimes that it talks about God's knowledge of the future. But listen to what the prophet Isaiah says in chapter 46, 9 and 10. It says, "Remember the former things of long ago, I am God, and there is no other. I am God, there is none like me. I've made known the end from the beginning, from the ancient times, what is still to come. I say my purpose will stand, and I will do what I please. Here God talks about His plans will come. His will be done. And that's what we'll look at this morning. But exactly how God knows the future is never spoken of in the Bible. Some say, well, if God doesn't know the future, if it's not just laid up like an open book for Him, aren't we limiting God? But on the other side of that same argument, if everything's already been determined, doesn't that limit God? We know that our prayers are heard by God and they have an effect. This morning, the idea of whether or not we understand exactly what's meant by the foreknowledge of God, we do know this. We will be judged by the choices that we make. We do have free will. And you'll see that in the story of Esther that we go through today. And that's the idea that each one of us, we have choices which we have to make. And God will judge us on those choices. And the fact that He will judge us means that we have free will. We can determine ourselves which decisions we make. And we'll see that as we go through the story of Esther. The story of Esther really begins, and we're going to start in chapter 3. It's about the time when the Jews were in what we would call the exile period, or they're actually in Persian captivity. If you remember the story of Israel, God gives Israel the promised land. And they live in it many hundreds of years, and He gives them the kings. But King Solomon, though he's a great king in many ways, he was also a very wicked king. And because of his great sins, God split the kingdom in two, the northern kingdom and the southern kingdom. The northern kingdom's taken to Assyrian captivity. The Assyrian army comes down and just wipes them away around 700 B.C. About 100 years later, Jerusalem falls to the Babylonians. And the Babylonians take Israel, or what's left of Israel and Judah, into what was called the Babylonian captivity. And in today's story, Mordecai and his cousin, that is actually his ward, Esther, went into the Babylonian captivity around 600 B.C. Now the Babylonians, if you remember the story of the writing on the wall, they're destroyed by the Persians. And the Persians destroy the Babylonian, and at that time, then Israel's really in sort of a Persian captivity. And this is around 550 B.C. or thereabouts, that Israel was basically living under the Persian rule. And in chapter 3 of the book of Esther, listen to what's said. King Xerxes, now he's the king over all of Persia. And the Persian Empire is a huge empire. It's one of the largest empires ever in the history of the world. It stretches all the way from India all the way up into Europe, all through Asia. The Persian Empire reaches from one end of the world to the other. At these events, King Xerxes honored Haman, elevating him and giving him a seat of honor higher than all the other nobles. All the royal officials at the king's gate knelt down and paid honor to Haman, for the king had commanded this concerning him. But Mordecai would not kneel down or pay him honor. Now the story begins, we find Haman, which we would basically call the prime minister. He was second only to the king, and the king had honored him. And actually it said that everybody else has to actually bow down to him, almost like they would for the king himself. But Mordecai, who we know is a Jew that's been taken to captivity, will not bow down to him. Now it says he's at the king's gate. That basically means he's a royal official serving the king in the palace, as Haman is himself. And you read on down, Haman, when he comes by Mordecai, Mordecai won't bow down to him. Haman becomes very angry, and he looks at a way he can get back at Mordecai. And he finally decides, I'm going to kill Mordecai, but I don't want to just kill Mordecai. I want to kill everybody associated with Mordecai. And Haman learns that Mordecai is a Jew. He said, I'm going to kill every single Jew in Persia just to get back at Mordecai. And that's what he devises to do. And he comes up with a plan to do that, and he takes his plan to the king. Remember, he's the prime minister. Now, if you remember, if you've ever read the story of Daniel in the lion's den, once a law was enacted by the Persians, the king himself could not change that law. And so Haman takes this law to the king. And the law says that anybody has any grievance against the Jews, they can just wipe the Jews out and confiscate their property. And Haman takes this law to the king, and he offers the king 10,000 talents of silver. This is a huge amount of money. Basically, it's a bribe to the king to allow him to do this. Now, his plan is to wipe out the Jews and confiscate their property, and in which case, he'd actually make money on this whole proposition. Well, the king goes along with it because Mordecai tells him that these Jews are people that don't obey your laws, and they're causing a lot of problems, and this is the way around all the problems these Jews are causing. And so Haman enacts this law to wipe out all the Jews throughout the entire Persian Empire. And when he enacts the law, you can think about exactly God's hand in all this as you go through the book of Esther. As we looked a few weeks back, God had made a covenant with Abraham that his children would be so numerous that you could not count them, just like the sand on the seashore. He repeats that to Jacob, to Isaac and to Jacob. And we also know the great covenant that God made with David, that upon his throne the Messiah would come and rule for all eternity, that his house would never end. These great covenants that God made to his people, well, they were in jeopardy now. Because if his people gets wiped out, what happens to God's great covenant to his people? And we'll see God's hand in his providence withholding his people as we go through. So when this happens, Mordecai learns of Haman's law. And when he learns of the law that Haman's done, Mordecai goes in sackcloth and ashes and goes in the mourning, because they posted this law throughout all the land. But when they post the land, they have to decide when they're going to enact the law. And so they draw lots to find out when the law will go into effect. It's roughly a year from now. So the Jews have some time to prepare. So the Jews go into mourning. And when Esther, who's become the queen, and we'll look at that, it's like, how could somebody from exile, almost like a slave, become the queen over Persia? And we'll take a look at God's hand in her life. When she hears about this, she sends one of her attendants out to ask Mordecai, what's going on? Why are you in sackcloth and ashes? Why are you in mourning? And Mordecai sends her a copy of the law and tells her what's going to happen. And then he urges her to go to the king on behalf of all the Jews to talk to the king to get this thing changed. And that's what we pick up. And I want you to notice that how they talk back and forth. Now, they have to do this through an emissary. But in chapter 4, verse 11, this is Esther's reply to Mordecai, when Mordecai urges her to go to the king. Esther says, All the king's officials and the people of the royal provinces know that for any man or woman who approaches the king in the inner court without being summoned, the king has but one law, and that he be put to death. The only exception to this is the king to extend the golden scepter to him and spare his life. But 30 days have passed since I was called to go to the king. Now, because she's queen, we would think, well, doesn't that mean she sees the king all the time? Well, remember, this was in the East. They had a harem. They had many, the king would have many wives, and so the chief wife would be the queen. As we were learning at the very beginning of the story, the old queen had actually been put aside. And what Esther is telling Mordecai, says, Mordecai, you just don't go to the king. If you go to the king and you haven't been summoned, the law is that you're put to death. Now, I haven't been summoned to see the king in 30 days. So I don't know what kind of relationship I have. He may be upset with me. If I go to see him and I haven't been summoned, I'll lose my life. He'll put me to death. Notice what Mordecai comes back to Esther. When Esther's words were reported to Mordecai, he sent back this answer. Do not think that because you're in the king's house, you alone of all the Jews will escape. For if you remain silent at this time, relief and deliverance for the Jews will arise from another place. But you and your father's family will perish. And who knows but that you've come to the royal position just for this time. And what Mordecai's telling her is that don't think you're going to get around this just because you're there in the harem and the king. If all the Jews are destroyed, you too will be destroyed. But notice what he says to her. He says, you have a choice to make. Either you can stand up for your people or not. God's will is going to, God's going to deliver his people. He says, you can be part of that or not. That's your choice, Esther. But he says, just think about this. Maybe God has made you queen over Persia just because of this. And so you're in the right place at the right time by God's hand. And this is Esther's reply to Mordecai. And in this reply, you start seeing the character of this young woman. And I think in through this whole story, you see Mordecai's faith in God, and you see Esther's character. Listen to what Esther says back to Mordecai. She says, "Go gather all the Jews who are in Susa and fast for me. Do not eat or drink for 3 days, night or day. I and my maids will fast as you do. And when this is done, I will go to the king, even though it is against the law. And if I perish, I perish." She was willing to lay down her life if that's what it meant. That's what she's saying. She says, "I'll go to the king, but if I it may be that I will die in going to the king." Well, if you read on through chapter 5, she goes to the king, and the king's glad to see her, and he extends the golden scepter to her. And so Esther comes to the king, and the king asks her, "Esther, what is it that you want? Anything that you want, I'll grant your request." And Esther says, "Well, I'm going to give a great banquet tomorrow, and you come to the banquet, and I'll tell you what my request is. And you bring Haman along with you." And so the next day, they go to the banquet, and she gives them a banquet. And Haman comes to the banquet, and the king says he's very pleased with her. He says, "Anything you want, Esther, I'll give it to you." And Esther said, "Well, come to a banquet tomorrow, and I'll make my request. So we'll have one more banquet, and bring Haman along." And so when that ends, Haman leaves. He feels like he's been tremendously honored. He said, "Queen Esther, she didn't invite anybody but the king and me." And so he basically is sort of on cloud nine when he leaves. And first thing he does when he leaves, guess who he sees? He sees Mordecai there. And Mordecai doesn't bow down to him and doesn't give him any honor. And it just sends Haman through the roof. He gets so upset. He's just in a rage. He says, "What am I going to do about this guy? This Jew, I've got to put him down." So he goes home and he talks to his wife and his friends, and his wife tells him, "Why don't you just build a gallows and hang the guy?" And so Haman says, "That sounds a pretty good idea. I think I'll do that." So he has a gallows built to hang him. But that night, king couldn't sleep. And so when the king couldn't sleep, he calls one of his attendants and he says, "You know, why don't you read me the chronicles of my reign, all the good things I've done, you know, because I just can't sleep tonight." And so they start reading to the king all the things that have gone on. And one of the stories that's read to him is a time when two of his attendants plotted to kill him. And Mordecai, who was found out about it, and Mordecai alerted Esther, and Esther told the king and saved the king. And the king heard this story. He says, "You know, what did we do to Mordecai? What kind of honor did we give him because he saved my life?" And the attendant was reading, "Well, there's nothing recorded. We didn't really do anything for Mordecai." And so the king, by that time, it's about sunrise and people coming to work. And he looks around and says, "Well, who's here?" And says, "Well, Haman, your prime minister, just walks in." And so Haman comes in and the king says, "Haman, what can we do to honor somebody that the king really wants to honor?" Well, Haman's sitting there and says, "Oh, the king's going to honor me. And I got to think of something really neat." And so he said, "What you ought to do is put him on a horse and put a great robe on him. And let's go through the whole town. Let's have a parade for him. Let everybody honor this guy." And so the king says, "That's a good idea, Haman. Let's do that for Mordecai." Can you imagine what Haman thought? And Haman said, "Ah." But Haman had to do it. So he gets to lead the horse all the way through the city, giving sort of like a parade like we would give, like one of our football teams wins the national championship or something. This kind of thing. They give him like a ticker tape parade through the city. And so at the end of the day, Haman's just worn out, and he's really kind of down in the dumps. And he goes home, and his wife tells him, "You know, that Jew Mordecai, God's with those people. This is not going to go good for you, Haman." And it's about that time the king's official comes, and they bring Haman over to the second banquet. So he goes to the second banquet, and Esther's there. And this time Esther tells the king about this terrible law that's been enacted that's going to wipe out all of her people. And the king says, who would enact such a terrible law as that? And she says, "This guy Haman, who's sitting right here." Well, the king just gets enraged. He actually walks out of the room. He's so mad. And when he comes back, Haman's sitting there almost on top of the queen, begging for his life. And the king gets so mad, he just throws Haman out. He says, "Why don't we just go?" And he ends up hanging Haman on the very gallows that Haman had built to hang Mordecai. So Haman is hung that day. And so then Esther goes back to the king. Mordecai's elevated up in rank, but they still have a problem with this law that's going to be enacted to kill all the Jews. So Mordecai comes up with a plan that before this goes into effect, the Jews are able to wipe out any of their enemies before their enemies can wipe them out. And that's exactly what happens. And in fact, all of Haman's house is wiped out. He has 10 sons, and all of them are hung as well. And the Jews end up being delivered by God in the province of Persia. In this story, we see God's hand almost from the very beginning to the very end. Well, one of the things you might wonder is, well, how in the world could Esther have become queen of Persia? Here she was, a Jew being taken into exile, almost like a slave when she gets there, but she becomes queen over all of Persia. And the story is an amazing story if you go through the first few chapters there. But what happens is the king has a great banquet for 7 days. And there's a lot of drinking going on. At the end of 7 days, he's sort of drunk. And he says, you know, I've got this beautiful queen. And I'm just going to let you guys see. And all of his officials there. And so he calls for the queen to come out so they can see her beauty. But at that time, in their customs, a woman didn't appear in public. She always had to have a veil. And so Queen Vashti sent back and says, I'm not going to parade in public in front of all your officials in this drunken banquet that you're giving. That's just not right. And so when the officials hear about this, they say, King, you can't let her get away with this. If you let your queen get away with not obeying what you said, what are our wives going to do? Our wives are going to do the same thing. Listen to what they say. This is in chapter 1, beginning verse 17. For the queen's conduct will become known to all the women, and so they will despise their husbands and say, King Xerxes commanded Queen Vashti to be brought down before him, but she would not come. This very day, the Persian, the Median women of nobility have heard the queen's conduct and respond to all the king's nobles in the same way. There will be no end to the disrespect and discord that's going to happen. So in order to keep this from happening, they said, we got to get a new queen. And so they send out throughout all the land for the very beautiful young virgins that are there, and they find Esther. And Esther is liked by one of the chief eunuchs, and he actually becomes her friend and raises her up to the king, and she becomes the queen. Throughout this whole story, you see God's hand happening, but sort of in the background, but you see his will being done. You see each of the people acting with their own free will. Haman with the evil plots that he has and the way that Mordecai offsets it. You see the king. You wonder, why did the king spend that night not being able to sleep? Why did the king want to hear about the story that was told that Mordecai, how Mordecai had actually saved him? All the pieces fit together in God's hand. But we see it all coming together as according to the providence of God. And you see the character of the people involved. You see the character of Esther. She was willing to go to the king even if it meant her own life. And you see that character of Mordecai. His faithfulness to God, even in what appeared to be death of all of his people. When we take a look at the providence of God, we know that God is active in our lives. He hears our prayers, and he expects us to do his will, just as Mordecai said to Esther. Look at a few verses with me in Philippians chapter 2, and verse 12. Paul writes, therefore, my friends, as you have always obeyed, not only my presence, but also my absence, continue to work out your salvation with fear and trembling. That's our part. We continue to work with our Lord. But notice the next side. For it is God who works in you to will and act according to his good purpose. We act according to God's plan for our lives. In Ephesians 2:10, Paul writes, for we are God's workmanship, created in Christ Jesus, to do the good works which God prepared in advance for us to do. Now, if you think about Mordecai's warning to Esther, when he comes to her and he says, Esther, I know this puts your life in danger, but you've got to stand up for your people. There are things that we are called to do that God has placed there for us to do. We're his workmanship. We're his people. He works within us to make us the kind of people we should be. But that's to do his good purpose, to do his will. In Romans chapter 2, Paul says, God will give to each person according to what he has done. In Jeremiah 17:10, I am the Lord. I search the hearts and examine the mind to reward a man according to his conduct, according to what his deeds deserve. We're called upon to do God's will, to do His plan, His purpose. We have a choice to make, just like Esther had a choice to make. Because sometimes doing God's will may not come easy. But that's what we're called to do. And according to, if we do God's will, then we know the reward that's waiting for us. We know the hope for heaven that we have. But if we choose not to, and that's our choice too, then just as Mordecai said to Esther, he said, you and your family will be destroyed. That too, Jesus says, unless you repent, you will perish. If you stay in this world, you will perish. When we look at providence of God, doesn't mean always everything's so easy. If you remember the story of Joseph we looked at last week, Joseph was sold into slavery. It was 13 years between the time he was sold into slavery that he was raised up to be second to Pharaoh. For 13 years, he was in prison and as a slave there in Egypt. Wasn't an easy path that God laid out for him. Yet, you remember what Joseph said, this was God's plan for me to be here. We looked at the life of Paul and all the things that Paul did and how God was with us. How many times do we pray for safe travel when we travel someplace and want God to give us safe travel? I know I do, and I think most of us do. Paul was shipwrecked 3 times. In his travels, on his missionary journeys for God, he was shipwrecked 3 different times. He said, one time I spent all night and all day in the sea. He was beaten 8 times, as we looked at. I mean, he lived a very hard life. He was stoned and left for dead once. But yet, God's hand was with him. And yet, we see all the great things that were accomplished and how God's plan worked out. As we look at the providence of God, we know that God's will, God's plan, will be done. Doesn't always mean it's going to be that easy for us. As Paul says in Romans 8:18, I consider that our present sufferings are not worth comparing to the glory that will be revealed in us. In 2 Corinthians 4:17, for our light and momentary troubles are achieving for us a glory that far outweighs them all. This morning, think about God's plan for your life. God has a plan for your life. He has, as he says, things he intends for us to do, great things, good things that he intends, that he's put for us to do. But it's our choice whether or not we do those or not. If you decided to follow after the Lord today, if you put him on in baptism, so arise and walk hand in hand with him in your life, or maybe you have already been baptized, but you really haven't been doing God's will in your life. You haven't chosen the right and shunned the wrong. Think about God's providence in your life and choose to follow Him today. If you have need to come in any way, won't you come as together we stand and sing.
My trouble will.